The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Lubbock, Texas, also known as Hub City, has always been a place riddled with violent crime. In the 1970s, a string of seemingly unsolvable murders rocked Hub City and Lubbock County. Though the immediate years preceding and following 1975 were no exception, that year in particular saw an almost 37% increase in only the first 3 months. Crime in the Hub City was up in a major way, and although officials sought to downplay the role homicide played in the figures around mid-year, it was prevalent, and indeed not down as they claimed. In a story titled "Crime Rate Skyrockets in Lubbock," the city's newspaper reported, in fact, that from January 1975 to the article's publication on July 23rd, the Hub City saw 21 murders, compared to 23 in total for the year of 1974. A month after the article ran, a gruesome and unspeakable slaying that baffled Lubbock police investigators. The perpetrator, it seemed, was a phantom. In contrast, a murder that occurred in the county a few months prior to the story's publication seemed cut and dry. But even with a clear suspect in mind, Lubbock County Sheriff's deputies were unable to bring up charges. Though it was obvious these two cases weren't connected, similarities shared between the victims, two young women, were difficult for authorities to ignore. On Tuesday, April 29, 1975, two laborers of Mitchell Farm, about 6 miles south of Wolforth, Texas, in Lubbock County, smelled a peculiar, foul odor. The smell was strong and distinct, something that was unfamiliar to them, so the two men followed the scent to an abandoned storm cellar on the property, about 15 yards from Texas State Highway 41. They climbed down the staircase and into the cellar and were horrified to find the origin of the odor. It was the badly decomposed body of a woman, wearing nothing but dark purple socks, which would later be identified as men's. The Lubbock County Sheriff's Office was quickly notified of the discovery, and deputies were dispatched to investigate. The department struggled to identify the body. The only way it seemed to do so was to put out an enlarged photograph of the unique ring the woman was wearing in the Lubbock Avalanche Journal, the newspaper that would reach the largest amount of locals. The plan worked, and quickly. As soon as the story was printed and released, alongside the photo of the ring, Kathy Stroud came forward and told police that she had made the silver ring for her sister a few years back. Her sister had been using it as a wedding ring. Kathy's sister was 18-year-old Vicki June Stroud Stokes, a 15-year resident of Lubbock. Vicki was born in Leveland, Texas, on November 1, 1956, to Dorothy and William Stroud. Besides Kathy, she had another sister and a brother. Just a couple months before her body was found, Vicki had married Donald F. Stokes, a 25-year-old disabled Vietnam veteran of the United States Marines. Kathy coming forward claiming the ring belonged to her sister wasn't enough for an official identification, but it took no time after the fact for police to positively identify the body as belonging to Vicki Stokes. The official identification was made exactly a week after the discovery, on Tuesday, May 6, 1975, by matching the decomposed body's thumbprint to the one on Vicki's ID. Vicki June Stokes was last seen alive by her mother when they had lunch together on Saturday, May 29th. Lubbock County Sheriff's deputies wanted first to speak with Vicky's husband, William, though her mother insisted that there had never been domestic violence or signs thereof between them. Deputies had trouble locating William at first, before the identification was complete, but the sheriff located and spoke with the man the day it became official. Since they'd been married only 7 weeks before the last time he'd seen her, Vicky Stokes moved in with William in his Leveland, Texas home, a small town located around 20 miles west of Lubbock's center. William told the sheriff that he and Vicky had gotten into an argument, and a bad one apparently, since the man didn't report his wife missing, thinking, he claimed, that the two had become estranged as a result of the fight. Vicky was free to come and go as she wished, William told the sheriff. He said she'd left before without telling anyone where she was going. The couple was at a Lubbock bowling alley on the night of Saturday, March 29th, and Vicky, William explained, became extremely intoxicated, and they fought. Not long after they got home, the man claimed, the phone rang, Vicky answered, and went into another room to talk. William said he didn't know who it was on the other side of the line, but minutes after the call ended, a dark green foreign car pulled up in front of the house. Vicky got in it, and the vehicle drove away. That was the last time, William said, he saw his wife. William told police he thought his wife had phoned since she left, to the best of his recollection, asking him if her mother could come over and pick up some clothing for her. The deceased woman's mother told police that several items of Vicky's clothing and jewelry were missing. The investigation into the death of Vicky Stokes was slow going, with few clues to lead detectives on a solid investigative path. The decomposition of Vicky's body clouded the young woman's cause of death. The medical examiner felt that the condition of her head was indicative of a wound capable of killing her. What that meant exactly was never clarified, but it was a moot point anyway, as the state of decay prevented any definitive ruling immediately. It is known that three of the woman's front teeth had been, quote, knocked out. There were no bullets found in Vicky's body, so a death as the result of a shooting was, at least, able to be ruled out. Some investigators thought that Vicky suffered major trauma to her shoulder area, perhaps a stab wound. Whether or not she'd been the victim of sexual assault was also unable to be determined. As they awaited a determination from the Texas Department of Public Safety Crime Lab, Lubbock deputies began interviewing Vicky's many friends, acquaintances, and family. Besides Vicky's mother, family members told investigators that they hadn't seen her in months, while friends and acquaintances alike told them that they hadn't seen the young woman since around the date she and her husband William argued at the bowling alley. It seemed obvious by these accounts, and William's questionable story, that police only had one true suspect, Vicky's husband himself, William F. Stokes. Justice of the Peace and pathologist F.H. Bolin told a Lubbock Avalanche Journal reporter that he and investigators with the Lubbock County Sheriff's Office believed that Vicky Stokes was killed on or around Sunday, March 30th, 1975, at an unknown location and subsequently placed in the storm cellar on Mitchell Farm property. But that didn't account for the bloody pillowcase and bloody mattress found alongside Vicky's body, and neither did Bolin's final ruling. The pathologist ruled Vicky's death as the result of strychnine poisoning, as traces of the chemical were found in her liver and kidneys. She'd ingested a deadly amount, Bolin said. Vicky's death was officially ruled a homicide. Bolin commented, however, on, quote, all that blood there, where Vicky was found, saying that there was, quote, no accounting for it. On his official certificate, Bolin wrote that alongside the strychnine poisoning, other factors likely contributed to the young woman's death. Around the same time the body of Vicky Stokes was found, a little over 100 miles to the southwest, near Hobbs, New Mexico, The body of Lorraine Sorrells was found floating in an oil slush tank. Like Vicky Stokes, Lorraine was nude and had been missing a similar period of time. She was badly decomposed. Lorraine's cause of death was a severe blow to her head by a blunt force object. Though the similarities were there, and Lubbock County Sheriff's deputies traveled to New Mexico to review Lorraine Sorrell's case, the murders were found to have no connection. Lorraine's rapists and killers in New Mexico were found, arrested, and charged a few months later, ultimately convicted, unlike Vicky Stokes' murderer, who has never been brought to justice. On June 27, 1975, an inquest for the slaying of Vicky Stokes was held at 10 a.m. 11 people were subpoenaed, and all but one of those subpoenas were served. William F. Stokes, Vicky's husband, was unable to be found. The man obviously knew, however, that the county was looking to serve him, as his attorney, John O'Shea, gave the Lubbock Avalanche Journal an interview before the day's edition hit the presses. O'Shea told a reporter for the newspaper that William had been admitted to a Colorado Veterans Hospital at Fort Lyons. He transferred there after treatment at a Reese Air Force Base facility in Lubbock, where the man had admitted himself not long after Vicky's body was found. His client was emotionally distraught, O'Shea said, and was in no state to attend the inquest. He was certainly in no state, the attorney continued, to be bothered by reporters. The following day, Justice of the Peace F.H. Bolin requested that John O'Shea represent William Stokes at the continuation of the inquest. It's unclear whether or not William ever gave testimony at any inquest into his wife's murder. In the subsequent years, the man continually moved, and his criminal record indicates multiple driving while intoxicated convictions, but little else. Vicky was buried at Rest Haven Cemetery, the same cemetery where another 18-year-old victim of murder was also laid to rest a little more than 4 months later. The two young women were the same age. They both attended the same Lubbock school, Coronado High, and were killed, of course, in the same year. Many, in fact, said the two knew and were friendly with each other, which is, it seems, highly likely. Both Vicky and the other victim were newlyweds and carried military dependency identification cards. Though there was no indication or evidence that the slayings of Vicky Stokes and Debbie Williamson were connected, the similarities between the women had law enforcement scrambling for answers. With the current state of the world, i.e. social distancing from friends and family, connecting and having fun with folks can seem impossible. A good way that I've found to maintain a connection with my loved ones, casually, competitively, and while adhering to social distancing suggestions, is the challenging and visually stunning game, Best Fiends. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. I've got a handful of folks who I compete with, and I send them little gifts and energy when they need it. They return the favor. I've also been delving into the special missions, and I'm particularly digging my character's solo mission levels. Best Fiends is pure eye candy. It's super colorful, and the characters are way cool. The game is totally casual, and that's good for me. I'm overwhelmingly busy. I play the game when I need a break from writing, recording, or editing, or when a break is even more needed
at the dreaded day job.
It's hours of fun right at your fingertips, and you can even play Best Fiends offline. Since you don't need internet to play, finding a Wi-Fi hotspot or using your cell phone's data plan isn't an issue. One of my favorite things about the game. Best Fiends has thousands of levels already, with new levels, events, and characters, all cute and some just downright cool, added every month. With over 100 million downloads and tons of 5-star reviews, Best Fiends is a must-play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Deborah Sue Williamson, known to most as Debbie, was born on November 1, 1956, to parents Willard and Joyce Agnew. She had three siblings, a brother, and two sisters. Debbie was full of life, her sister would later recall, and a kind soul who treated everyone around her with gratitude and respect. In 1973, when she was 16 years old, Debbie moved from her childhood home in the small town of Childress, Texas, to the considerably larger city of Lubbock. Childress at the time had a population around 5,500, so moving to Lubbock, where there were almost 150,000 residents, was quite a change. At a local McDonald's fast food restaurant, Debbie met Wendell Douglas Williamson, who went by Doug, and the two hit it off immediately. Their romance developed quickly, and the couple was soon madly in love. They were married just after Debbie graduated from Lubbock's Coronado High School on June 14, 1975. Marriage seemed to suit Doug and Debbie, and the first 2 months went by well as they adjusted to their new lives as a couple in their Lubbock home, located on 82nd Street. The area was a quiet and semi-isolated suburban neighborhood, a few miles south of the heart of the city. On the evening of Sunday, August 24, 1975, 18-year-old Debbie joined her parents for dinner at a restaurant in town. Doug was working that night, so Debbie came home to an empty house when they dropped her off a little after 8:30 p.m. At about 9, perhaps a few minutes before, Debbie called Doug at work, a pizza restaurant, and told him she'd head up there soon and work some crossword puzzles while she waited for him to finish his shift. Since Doug most often worked evenings and nights, Debbie usually came up and waited for him to get off. Being at home alone a lot, Debbie had begun to develop a paranoid fear of being physically and sexually assaulted. The feelings had recently gotten worse since her 8-year-old sister Liz had just gone back home after spending the summer at Debbie and Doug's, and especially after Debbie received a threatening phone call in mid-August. She'd been so fearful to be home alone, in fact, that she expressed her concerns to Doug and her parents. When Debbie didn't show up at the pizza place, Doug worried some but figured the young woman had simply dozed off. A little after 1 a.m., now Monday, August 25th, Doug finished up his shift and left. He arrived home about 10 minutes later to the unthinkable. On the back patio, about 27 feet from the home's carport, Debbie Sue Williamson laid on the hot concrete in a pool of blood. Her blouse was pulled up, her pants pulled down, and her underwear was partially removed.
"My wife, she's been raped,"
Doug told police when he called them at 1:14 a.m. Not long after responding officers arrived, presumably after they announced the disturbing crime scene on the police radio, a plethora of both Lubbock police officers and state law enforcement arrived. Debbie and Doug's home was inundated with authorities. They came in such numbers, in fact, that it seemed unclear who was calling the shots. Confusion and a lack of management at the crime scene caused evidence to be mishandled, moved, destroyed, and possibly resulted in overlooked clues. An unnamed source close to the investigation later told the local paper, the Lubbock Avalanche Journal, that in the many years he has spent in law enforcement, he'd never seen a worse handled and sloppy crime scene. Debbie had been repeatedly stabbed in the carport and dragged face down to the back porch, which some investigators initially thought was the reason Debbie's clothing was partially removed. When she was dragged to the back patio, she was turned over and positioned by her killer face up, purposely displayed, detectives later said, in a sexually provocative manner. Debbie's keys and a pen laid not far from the body, and underneath her, a crossword puzzle book. It was obvious that she'd been on her way out to head to where Doug worked when she was attacked. The home's back door, police said, was open, but the lock was in the locked position. The kitchen window was broken. The slaying occurred, authorities theorized, between 9:30 and 10 p.m. the previous night, not long after she called Doug at work to tell him she was on her way up. Investigators worked to keep the husband calm, not only for the good of the inspection of the scene, which police had already botched anyway, but also for the information. Doug found her body and was perhaps the closest person to Debbie, so it was only natural the cops check him out first. They found out quick that the man couldn't have slain his wife. His alibi was as rock solid as they come. Even though the initial response by law enforcement at the scene had been problematic, some evidence was able to be saved. Debbie Sue Williamson's hand clutched a strand of hair, and fingerprints left by an unidentified person were found. A murder weapon, however, was nowhere to be found, and there were no witnesses. Debbie's purse, which is thought to have contained over $100, was missing. The day following Debbie's murder, her husband Doug discovered that the couple's wedding photo album was also gone, though detectives brushed its disappearance off, commenting that they didn't think it had anything to do with the young woman's murder. The night Debbie was slain, her husband Doug said, the wedding album was there, but it had disappeared since. At the autopsy on Debbie Sue Williamson's body, the Lubbock County Medical Examiner determined that the 18-year-old was stabbed at least 17 times in her upper torso, back, neck, and head. The murder weapon, the pathologist said, was a fixed, double-edged knife. Scrapings of blood and biological material were taken from under Debbie's fingernails. More evidence, sure, but in 1975, technology didn't allow for DNA comparisons on such material. Texas Department of Public Safety Crime Labs analyzed the blood and biological evidence, but did not release the results of what they found. Though the condition of her clothing and the position in which her killer left her suggested sexual assault, it was determined that Debbie wasn't raped or sexually molested in any way. Detectives were perplexed. The slaying didn't appear to be outwardly sexually motivated, and they struggled to determine why she was killed, a detail that might help provide them with a starting lead. Perhaps, investigators thought for a moment, Debbie had interrupted a burglary. The glass of the kitchen window, after all, was broken. But in the blood where the woman laid, and atop her body, shards of glass were found, meaning the window was broken after she'd already been killed. It was theorized that the perpetrator wanted to throw off police by making Debbie's murder look like a burglary gone wrong. The glass and the fact that nothing of value was taken, however, led detectives to quickly rule it out. Debbie's missing purse and perhaps her wedding photo album were soon thought to have been taken by the killer as trophies by some detectives. Detectives also briefly ran with the theory that someone had a grudge on Debbie, but found she had no enemies. By all accounts, Debbie was friendly and helpful to everyone she knew or came across, and lived her life clean. Certainly not a likely victim for homicide. For unknown reasons, some family members were scrutinized. The identity of exactly who, also unknown. Lubbock police later told the local newspaper that they'd given polygraph examinations to at least 15 individuals, perhaps 20, all who they considered strong suspects. They didn't elaborate on why they considered them such. Presumably, the individuals were known violent offenders. The usual suspects, perhaps. At least a few were simply people who just happened to be in the area around the time of Debbie Sue Williamson's slaying. Individuals who police had labeled as suspicious, for whatever the reason. Some incidents after Debbie's murder gave police pause, such as a burglary attempt at her parents' Buffalo Spring Lake home, just east of Lubbock. Debbie was buried at Rest Haven Cemetery, her last rites performed by the minister who married her and Doug, and visitors at Debbie's grave also raised investigators' eyebrows. Though the details of exactly who they were or what they did there weren't expounded upon. 3 days after Debbie Sue Williamson was found by her husband when he returned home from work, stabbed to death, and laying face up in a pool of blood on her back porch, on Thursday, August 28, 1975, an unidentified man walked into the Lubbock Police Department and turned over a knife he'd found off U.S. Highway 87. The Lubbock man thought he was helping police. He thought maybe it was the weapon used to kill Debbie, but the knife was old and rusty, and investigators discounted it being the murder weapon. The following day, August 29th, at 12:15 a.m., Lubbock police arrested a man at a donut shop located at the intersection of 50th Street and Avenue R. The 23-year-old man, who police wouldn't identify to reporters, had approached an area woman at her home, professing his love for her daughter. The woman's daughter was soon to be married, and the unidentified man pleaded with her to call off the wedding. When police arrested the man, however, it wasn't this incident that they wanted to talk to him about, though the incident did lead them to him, piquing detectives' interest. Rather, police wanted to question him about the murder of Debbie Sue Williamson. They did, and determined the man had nothing to do with her slaying. Debbie's family believed, given the severity of her injuries, which seemed to have been inflicted as an act of passion, of overkill, that someone she knew killed her. They just had no idea who. Neither the family nor police could find anyone with such a motive. The investigation fizzled, and the case went ice cold. Almost 10 years after Debbie Sue Williamson's slaying, police would heavily pursue a conviction when serial confessor Henry Lee Lucas took responsibility for the crime. Henry Lee Lucas was arrested for unlawful possession of a firearm in June of 1983 and quickly confessed to 2 murders that there is little doubt he's responsible for, his landlord and his underage lover. Not long after, however, he began confessing to virtually every case investigators brought his way, from Texas to Florida to Minnesota and everywhere in between. With the influence of Williamson County, Texas's glory-seeking and arguably psychopathic sheriff Jim Boutwell and pridefully dense Texas Ranger Bob Prince, investigators began spoon-feeding Lucas with case details allowing him to take credit for murders all over while being rewarded with cheeseburgers, milkshakes, and private jet rides. Lucas loved it. When the Lubbock police caught wind, they paid Sheriff Boutwell and his jailed celebrity liar a visit. Lucas, with Boutwell officiating, took the bait, and it wasn't long before he was charged for Debbie Sue Williamson's murder, along with 2 others in Lubbock, the April 10, 1976 slaying of Elizabeth Price, and the January 31, 1971 killing of Naomi Miller Martin. He was with Otis Toole when he took Debbie's life, Lucas said, but there was an immediate problem with this, as no one was ever able to place Lucas and Toole even crossing paths before 1979, 4 years after Debbie was violently stabbed to death. The Lubbock County District Attorney all but immediately called bull on Lucas's involvement, and Debbie's parents began cooperating with him to disprove it. When shown the written confession, Debbie's parents knew Lucas didn't kill their daughter. The details he provided, even while being coached by Lubbock police detectives, was all wrong. The famously outspoken and camera-friendly McLennan County, Texas, District Attorney Vic Fiesel also joined the cause, as did Dallas's whistleblowing hero journalist, Hugh Ainsworth. This anti-Lucas task force, perhaps they should be called, also had a friend in a high place, Texas Attorney General Jim Maddox. When Maddox's attention was drawn to the rebuttals to Henry Lee Lucas's confessions, he took note and began an investigation of his own, charging his staff with finding detailed accounts of the serial confessor's whereabouts through the 1970s up until his arrest. In Jim Maddox's Lucas Report, released in 1986, it's clear that he wasn't anywhere near Texas when Debbie was slain, and in fact, the man had stayed with friends in Port Deposit, Maryland that very night. Though Henry Lee Lucas was considered the most prolific American serial killer thereafter, Debbie's case was vital in the series of events which all but disproved this notion. A majority of the cases he confessed to and was brought up on charges for, Maddox's Lucas report showed his involvement was either an impossibility or improbability, but many continue to this day to portray Lucas's lies as fact. Some in law enforcement won't take the hit to their pride by admitting wrongdoing, and some outside of law enforcement still perpetuate Lucas's lies, glorifying him. For this story's purposes, it is a fact that his confession to the murder of Debbie Sue Williamson was a complete fabrication. It should also be noted that Debbie Sue Williamson's parents played a heroic and unmistakably important role in proving Henry Lee Lucas a fraud, and it all but bankrupted them. The family says they were even threatened by law enforcement. The family was not given credit due to them on the recent Netflix documentary series about Lucas. In recent years, a nonprofit team of retired law enforcement investigators, collectively known as the Cold Case Foundation, picked up Debbie's case. In 2017, Lubbock Police Sergeant Mark Wall commented that Debbie's case was difficult, but not forgotten by the department. Sergeant Wall suggested that in a cold case, time is perhaps a detective's friend. After 4 decades, relationships change, and consciences can get the best of someone with knowledge of a crime, perhaps leading them to come forward. The Lubbock police, it seems, are waiting for that one call, that missing puzzle piece, however small, that will solve Debbie Sue Williamson's murder case. It is unclear whether the department was able to obtain a DNA profile of her killer. The slayings of Debbie Sue Williamson and Vicki June Stokes weren't the first, and certainly weren't the last, in which the perpetrator slipped through the hands of Lubbock City and Lubbock County authorities in the 1970s. That's next time on Gone Cold. If you have any information on the murder of Debbie Sue Agnew Williamson or the murder of Vicki June Stroud Stokes, please contact the Lubbock Crime Line at 806-775-1489. You can support Gone Cold at patreon.com/gonecoldpodcast. Donors at all levels there get the show ad-free, and for just $2.50 a month, you'll have access to episodes featuring stories of mostly solved Texas crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them, exclusive to Patreon, such as the Riverside Village Massacre and the Odessa Lust Murders, among many others. If you're listening and you're already a donor, be on the lookout later this month for an exclusive episode on the known and depraved crimes of lesser-known Texas serial killer Michael Eugene Sharp. Thanks to everyone who supports us there. We appreciate it beyond words. The Lubbock Avalanche Journal, the Odessa American, and Esquire.com were used as sources for this episode. Thanks for listening, y'all.